Dusty Rhodes and Tony Schiavone, Harlem Heat and the Nasty Boys. You know, we talk about intensity. Brother, you getting ready to see it. Don't go to the icebox. Don't go get nothing to drink, because anything could happen in this thing right here. This could be Penny City for the Harlem Heat.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 64 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, we'll be looking at WCW main event from April 2nd, 1995, because I've clearly developed a thing for the WCW C and D shows. If WCW had an E, an F, a G, H show, I would review those, too. Fortunately, it only goes down so far, and in looking at YouTube, as I talked about at the end of last week's show, there are no episodes of WCW Prime on there right now, so I kind of have to turn to Daily Motion, but I still kind of want to keep the community aspect of this. I don't know how many of you, beyond listening to the podcast, actually watch the episodes that I've gathered in a playlist on my YouTube page. So I created a list of the episodes that I've reviewed. It's a bit of a mess now because many of those shows are gone. I think episodes 37 through 44 are all gone off YouTube in one form or another. Like, you can't view them anymore because either they've been blocked by WWE or whatever. So kind of my plan has gone sideways from that perspective, but it's what I prefer to do. But I think I'm going to be taking a look at other ways of reviewing shows coming up and going forward. First, let me get in my plugs. Email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. On Twitter, give me a follow, @GFAllentownPod. Very happy to get some positive feedback on the AWA show I did last week in episode 63. As I said, I'm always a little nervous when I cover something really, I know the term is wrestle crappy, but something like the Wrestle Rock Rumble video, where there's really only one of them in history, and I'm never going to be able to do something like that again. I'm glad that I was able to do it justice in some form. And you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place B Nation. Go to placebnation.com/Amazon for all of your Amazon purchases. And I never got around to buying a new can of coffee. I probably won't buy Tim Hortons on there, except for when my wife is traveling, because I like to have the Tim Hortons, and she's very much sick of it. But since I'm going to Long Island the next 2 weekends for First Communions, see, we have nephews down there, and they are at that age where they are getting their first communion in the local Catholic church, and unfortunately they live far enough apart that it is separate churches, so I have to go down 1 week and then go down again the following week, which I'm more than happy to do because I love going down there and hanging out with the family down there. It's just the travel between here and Long Island can be a little difficult sometimes, you know, with the Connecticut-ness of it all. Apologies to Scott Criscoll or any Connecticut listeners here, but I mean, you know what the deal is there. But they have a Tim Hortons down there. I can probably buy a can of it with the gift card that I have, and maybe I'll even make it back in time for the Orioles-Red Sox game on Sunday the 20th that I have tickets for. As I'm scratching my head, wondering why I even bother to follow sports, as the Boston Bruins get knocked out in five games, as I predicted in my NHL playoff preview. Yeah, granted, I had the wrong round, but they did lose in five games. And the Baltimore Orioles, as I speak, I cannot, literally cannot remember, as I record this, they may have beaten Kansas City one of the last two nights. I don't know. Maybe it was rainouts or something like that. But as I sit here right now, their record is 8-26. And things are pretty bleak. But at least I know that the whole rest of the season is going to be a waste of time, so I can just kind of strap myself in and enjoy it. It'll be one hell of a toboggan ride. It's a matter of just enjoying the moments as they happen, you know, for whatever few positive ones there are. I did mention this on the Twitter, that if this podcast was taking place in my life 8 or 10 years ago, I would have done a complete preview of the Kentucky Derby, but I don't really have the time for it anymore. Part of that is the fact that I won't bet on the race online, and the place that I used to go to bet on such horse races has been torn down, and it's going to be gentrified in some way with some mixed use development. You know, one of those buzzwords that up at by Rockingham Mall or Mall at Rockingham Park. See, Salem, New Hampshire has Mall at Rockingham Park, but then they also have the Rockingham Mall, and they're two different things. And even though I've lived in this area for quite some time, I only realized the distinction between the two about a year ago, just from looking at signs. And as the old saying goes, you can learn a lot by looking at stuff. So anyway, you know, to make myself feel better with all the sports stuff going on, you got to do stuff that you enjoy. And I guess for me, it's throwing a crap ton of grass seed on the ground right before it rains, along with lawn food, going to run 2.5 miles at the high school, and then finally cooking a 6-pound pork shoulder so that you could have pulled pork for a significant period of time, my wife and I. And maybe some tips on cooking a pork shoulder. Maybe I'll come up with a segment for that at some point. Just, you know, Chef Pete's cooking tips or Chef Pete recommends or something like that. Because I really like to barbecue, you know, grill. I guess grill is the more popular term, although I do try to fashion a smoker out of my Weber grill, which is actually gas, because you have to use like the wood chips. But enough about grilling for now. That's really for another time. So yeah, there will be shows the next few weeks. It's just that I'll be traveling on the weekends, both those weekends, which actually, when I get to my destination, I'll certainly have plenty of free time to actually watch wrestling, which is another one of the things that I particularly enjoy and that now I can get back to on a more regular basis, along with my Mad Men rewatch. So enough hooey about my own life here. WCW main event. I know I've covered one of these in the past, I think very early on around episode 18. I think I did one from 1990 when Missy Hyatt was hosting with Jim Ross. And to refresh your memory on this, this is the Sunday night show that would air on TBS and would often lead in to pay-per-view shows. Here, though, in 1995, April of that year, they're really just kind of showing stuff from other shows that had happened, like from Worldwide, WCW Saturday Night, because we don't have Nitro yet. That's not for another 5 months or so, as that's being chronicled on Wrestling War with Chad Campbell and JT Rizzero. And I hope I got the name of that show right, because I've really enjoyed the three episodes that they've released so far, one of which was talking about Fall Brawl 95, which I have to admit is a pay-per-view that I don't think about very much. And I kind of enjoy WCW 95. As we get into this, you'll kind of, you know, get a sense for that. And it's not just WCW Prime. There's a lot of other stuff there. But this show, WCW Main Event, it's like a toned-down version of what we'd later get with Sunday Night Heat, like a less coked-up version. Thinking of you, Shane McMahon, announcing, and the fact that you just never shut up. I did cover a Sunday Night Heat, actually, the halftime heat. It was around episode 34 or so, somewhere in the middle of my run. I said to somebody on Twitter that I'm starting to get episodes confused a little bit. Like, I can't remember stuff off the top of my head, which is a good sign because now I'm up to 64 episodes, and I really didn't think I was ever going to get this far. A main event started in early 1988 in an effort to kind of ramp up the TV, get more name guy, name brand, you know, big time matches on television, which they did for a very brief period. I always love when a wrestling promotion starts up this new show with like this new concept, like Shotgun Saturday Night starts up in the nightclub and they give up on it after about 6 or 7 weeks. And then it just becomes exactly like all the other shows. And so it is with Main Event, where it's not so much a recap show here, where they're talking about stuff that happened. That happens more when you get into the Nitro era, when that is like the undisputed place where stuff happens. And of course, later you have Thunder come along, and WCW Main Event was actually canceled in early 1998. So it was a casualty of WCW Thunder being added into the mix. So just remember, when they added 2 hours of Thunder, they did subtract in other areas. It's just that Thunder being a live show, as I recall at first, and then later taped, was more high leverage than something like WCW Main Event, where you literally could have thrown anything out there, and I don't think it really would have mattered much because, you know, it was what it was, just like the rest of these C and D shows. I know I'm a fan of WCW Prime, but eventually I will get back to that at some point, because they are on Daily Motion. It's just a matter of sorting through which one you want to see. You know, I'm probably not going to even look at one that doesn't have Dusty Rhodes in it, because he's the undisputed star of that. Now, as for WCW in 1995, Ric Flair is there, but he's kind of on the outside looking in. As you recall, he kind of lost a retirement match to Hulk Hogan at Halloween Havoc 94. And here to this point, some 6 months later, he is living up to the stipulation. And this is done to give Hulk Hogan a little bit of space. After you have the initial program with Flair and Hogan that the WWF inexplicably just decided to give up on in midstream because, as the legend goes, Vince didn't like the turnout at some house show in Tampa or wherever the hell it was, even though everything was declining across the board, and the fact that he was giving it away on house shows probably was not very helpful in the first place. Flair was never really gone from the hearts and minds of anybody who was a fan of WCW. I mean, he was always there in the background, and as such, they would always turn back to him. In fact, by the end of this calendar year, 1995, who is your WCW World Champion? Once again, it is Ric Flair defeating Randy Savage, just as it was in WWF 1992, at least shortly after SummerSlam 92. And Flair is a big part of this show because there are two specific points where he appears. First, in a really remarkable piece of business. And I say this not because it was funny intentionally, but there's a lot of humor that can be mined in this meeting of the WCW Executive Committee, where they vote as to whether to reinstate Nature Boy Ric Flair to World Championship Wrestling. And then later on, Flair buys time, kind of reminding me a bit of the NWO's quote-unquote time buys that would come a year and a half later, where they would do the black and white vignettes and all that. Instead, Flair just kind of puts himself over, and he's working comedic bits. There's a lot of comedy in WCW 95, which is why I like it quite a bit. Now, Flair, it's on the heels of the Uncensored pay-per-view. That was the last pay-per-view that they had had at this time, where Flair was dressed up as a woman doing his run-in. And not Nancy Sullivan. He was dressed up as a woman in, I don't know, nylons, a dress, or whatever. And a lot of people get really offended. Oh, how could you make Ric Flair dress up like a woman? And I just look at it as, you know, a laughable, funny thing in his career. Hey, Ronnie Garvin did it as Miss Atlanta Lively. less than a decade before. Maybe this is, you know, just kind of a rite of passage for NWA champions of the 1980s. I'm sure they asked Harley Race to put on a dress, and he probably replied back, "You've got to be fucking kidding me. I'm not putting on a fucking dress." And that's then they said, all right, we're not going to ask Harley Race anything like that again. I also think that maybe this was Rick in kind of a Mel Gibson What Women Want scenario, where maybe he was dressing up as a woman to kind of gain a greater insight so that he could then get more tail at the end of the day. The thing you have to admit about Flair, he's always thinking, and he's always thinking about getting more tail. I don't know, but here's, on this show, I always like to have a hook, and there is a definite hook, at least from my perspective. I kind of do shows that interest me and pique my interest. In fact, I got a recommendation from somebody on Twitter. I don't have my phone near me, otherwise I would look up exactly who it was. They had actually sent me a DM on Twitter telling me, you got to check out some Memphis wrestling from the year 2001. And I was like, hmm. And then I get a mention of, oh, it's got some early Bryan Danielson. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Because I actually, as I'm taping this, I was watching Backlash and his match with Big Cass. And it's so nice to have Daniel Bryan back after all this time. It's almost as, to me, it's almost as if the 2015 thing didn't happen. Like, I'm thinking all the way back to 2014. And just how that completely sucked me in. It really makes me feel good to see him out there. Anyway, 2001, young Daniel Bryan, and I was watching a few minutes of a show on YouTube, and he's on there, and just seeing him at that time is so remarkable. And for whatever reason, Lord Steven Regal is there too, and I was left scratching my head. And he is on this show as well, kind of making Bobby Eaton a proper member of British society. And this is some of my favorite vignette work that was ever done. Once again, going back to WCW at this time, for whatever reason, they had a lot of flaws. Some of their stuff wasn't together completely. There were some clear errors, taping stuff in the wrong order, and all that. But they were doing comedy fairly well around this time. Probably better than even some sitcoms of the era. The main event on this show, which is actually the main event of main event, because it's a main event exclusive. Pardon me for saying that too many times. And this goes into the tag title confusion, which I'll get into later. Harlem Heat, who are the champions that time in April 95, taking on their challengers, the Nasty Boys. Again, another tag team match that was from WCW Saturday Night with Arn Anderson and Steve Austin in one of his last shots, or, well, maybe not one of his last shots, but he's not in WCW much longer in 1995 before he heads over to the rest area that's known as ECW and then eventually to the World Wrestling Federation at the tail end of 95. They're taking on a very unique team of Johnny B. Badd and the Triple H killer Alex Wright. And so that was kind of a fun match to see from the perspective of this podcast, because as you know, I'm a big fan of really of all four of those guys. And and Sergeant Craig Pittman is on this show too, as he had recently started wrestling on television. He had been wrestling at live shows for quite some time in 1994, but he only started to get pushed on television a little bit before this. So with all that in mind, let's just jump right into the show. I love Freak Like Me by Idina Howard so much. It's kind of an example of, she probably should have named the album Do You Want to Ride Freak Like Me instead, because it probably would have sold more album copies, because I think the album peaked in the low 30s on the charts, but that song went all the way to number 2, and I'm forever fascinated by songs that stall out at number 2 and what other song kept it from getting to number one. In this case, it was Montel Jordan's This Is How We Do It. Another example of a guy named Jordan keeping somebody worthy from reaching number one in the 1990s. That song is so great. I wanted it to be like my theme song if my friend was going to create me in WrestleMania 2000. He's like, oh, I can't do that. And I'm like, all right, well, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm just going to make you a Lord Stephen Regal British snob character. I said, okay, good enough for me. You had Bobby Heenan, Gene Okerlund here. And they're giving me flashbacks to an earlier time in the 90s, early 93, when they were hosting those All-American Wrestling in front of a green screen in various areas of the country. Here it's just two guys at a desk facing the camera, so it's also making me think of Mid-South Wrestling from the early 80s with Boyd Pierce and Bill Watts. They have an extended back and forth over why Sensuous Sherry, or Sister Sherry, it seemed like they were going back and forth with the name, almost like they couldn't make up their mind. Or maybe she was only Sister Sherry when she was with Harlem Heat. I can't quite figure that out. Why would she put Harlem Heat in against the Nasty Boys? And they go back and forth. And nobody really seems to know. It's very indicative of WCW in 1995. And going forward, quite honestly. And then they get to the talk of bringing Ric Flair back. And it is mentioned that it's done at the request of Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, because of course it is. It's not, you know, a fan request, because why would the fans want to request this heel, Ric Flair, to be back in their lives as a pro wrestler on a regular basis? In this case, WCW went ahead and did kind of a sensible business thing where they went to the 5-person WCW executive committee and had them vote on whether Ric Flair should be reinstated. The head of the committee is the commissioner, the man who taught Grandmaster Flash everything he knows, Nick Bockwinkel. And Bock, like any great rapper, I'm thinking Dr. Dre, Jay-Z, he's as comfortable at the boardroom table as he is in the studio, cutting, you know, a new track or whatever. So he's introducing the... I still can't... First of all, not only the great rap by Bock that on last week's show, but also this executive committee, the absurdity of which... Well, half of it is serious, and then part of it is absurd and certainly not on purpose.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, there has been a request by WCW heavyweight champion Hulk Hogan and Randy Macho Man Savage that Ric Flair be reinstated into the game. At this point, he is retired. This will take a vote by this, the Executive Board of World Championship Wrestling. And we're going to take that vote right now, and I'm going to immediately go to Mr. Gary Jester for both your vote and any comment that you might have.
I'm a great admirer of Ric Flair and his career. However, he made an agreement with WCW in October that he would retire if he lost to Hulk Hogan. And I believe he should honor that commitment, and therefore I would vote no on the reinstatement.
Okay. One no. Now, Tatiana, the Paz of Spain, please. Any statement?
All right, hold up here. You got Tatiana de Paz, whoever that is. I could find no information on this person other than somebody put up a YouTube video asking, who is Tatiana de Paz? And I thought I was going to get some answers there, but no, nobody knows who this person is. They somehow felt the need to have a representative from Spain on this imaginary WCW board of directors. Why Spain? Did it have to be because of language or whatever? Just think of this. This is reality here. WCW toured Europe in 1994, shortly after Hulk Hogan's arrival. I want to say it was in September, just before that Fall Brawl pay-per-view. They went to Germany, and they do have a German on this. Dieter Krapp. His last name is Krapp, but it's Krapp. It's not crap, it's Krapp, because he has the little umlauts on there like Spinal Tap. He actually did vote to reinstate Ric Flair because he knew it would be good for TV. They also went to Switzerland on that European tour, but there's no Swiss representative on the panel here. And they also went to England, United Kingdom. No representative from that country on here. But somehow Spain, I have no idea if they ever actually ran Spain in the entire history of WCW. Wasn't going to go through all the results up to like 97, 98, and whatever. I don't remember. The only wrestling thing that I ever remember from the country of Spain is that bizarre Tito Santana versus The Undertaker match from October of 1991, where Tito won cleanly over The Undertaker. I love that match very much because it's something that you wouldn't believe happened unless you actually saw it. So Tatiana is talking in English, but it's also dubbed over in English, but she's trying to do like an accent where they're pretending that it's Spanish. And she votes no, so it's 0-2 for Flair. Then we get Dieter Krop. Now it's 1-2. Then Kensuke Ishikawa, and that name sounded familiar to me for some reason. At first, I thought it was a relief pitcher in Major League Baseball or something. It actually turns out to be some sort of director, producer for some sort of anime thing. That's about as far away from my world as you could possibly get. No relation to Travis Ishikawa, former first baseman in Major League Baseball, played for the Orioles and a bunch of other teams. He actually only played 6 games for the Orioles in 2013. But the guy portraying this would later go on to become Sonny Ono later on in WCW and win a racial discrimination lawsuit settlement from them. It's like a lot of people won those kind of settlements from WCW over the years. And he voted to reinstate here. So now it's 2-2. We're going to the last person, Christine LeBlanc, who is actually a woman named Christine Johnson, who I don't think certainly was the Christine Johnson who is a Spanish teacher at my high school. Again, going back to Spanish there. And inexplicably, she was actually a TV producer for WCW. She votes to abstain on this, which makes me wonder, what the hell are you doing there? There is a place to abstain from voting, such as if you're in a congressional body, you feel like you have a conflict of interest or something like that, where you really don't feel right voting either yes or no on something. I have voted to abstain on things that I've done in my life. The Harvard Model United Nations in 1996. Me and my friend Mill Moore forming the mega powers of Model UN, representing Norway on the UN Environment Program in that committee. And we had worked very hard on this bill, and when it came to a vote, we abstained with rights, which allowed us to make the little speech afterwards explaining why we would abstain. Still talked about in Model UN circles to this day. We did win an award for that performance, and I'm quite proud of that. So it's 2-2-1, and I don't quite understand why Nick Bockwinkel doesn't get to vote to break a tie that occurred among a voting block of 5 people. I'll let Bock try to explain it.
You've just heard it, ladies and gentlemen. That is 2 for, 2 against, and 1 abstention, meaning that no action can be taken on the request and things will stay status quo. Ric Flair, at this point, is not re-entering today.
There you have it. Heenan would take issue with it back at the desk, but just a reminder that there is no more sacred thing in this world than a wrestling stipulation. It is to never be broken, ever. If you have a haircut match, somebody's got to be shaved bald. Like, there's no weaseling your way out of it. You hear what I'm saying, Smoky Mountain Wrestling? And there was also a question, and it's been brought up in a couple of different circles on this. It was mentioned both at the desk by those guys and in various YouTube comments I've seen on this segment. And there's also a thread on Pro Wrestling Only devoted to this segment with the WCW Executive Committee asking the question, how did Nick Bockwinkel know all these languages? And the answer is because he's a friggin' gangsta, okay? And he knows how to speak all these languages. And in addition to that, just like Barbara Billingsley before him. Nick Bockwinkel, just in case it was ever going to come up, knew how to speak jive. Speaking of people who call themselves Big Papa, I was thinking, because I was renting my car for my trip to Atlanta next month to inexplicably see the Orioles play the Braves, and I looked, and it is a 20-minute drive from my hotel up to Acworth, Georgia, to the Shoney's that Scott Steiner owns, and I almost certainly have to go there and do a segment of the podcast just reviewing that restaurant. I feel like that would be a lot of fun. Anyway, not relating to Scott Steiner or Shoney's. Brian Pillman here. Still from Hollywood, despite not being with the Blondes. Part of the gimmick in 95 was they briefly called him California Brian, which is a little clumsy. I don't think the word California in a name works very well for TV, and that goes double for that awful James Spader character from The Office. He's taking on Bobby Starr, and he's called Bobby Starr to differentiate himself from the sportscaster Bob Starr, who I know best as being the Red Sox radio broadcaster from 1990 to 1992. And looking up information on the wrestler Bob Starr, the sportscaster Bob Starr, I only remember him from when I went to Sportscaster Camp in 1992, and yes, I went to Sportscaster Camp. That is a real thing that happened. Unfortunately, it was the last one that they ever had run by that guy. Bob Starr's announcing kind of became a bit of a punchline at that camp for whatever reason. But Bobby Starr, he's only 47 years old right now, and it's kind of funny to sort of think about that, considering Ric Flair is approaching that age as this show is airing. He was 46, you know, doing his segments. And Starr was prominent in the Mid-Eastern Wrestling Federation, which kind of ran, I want to say, sort of the Mid-Atlantic areas, based out of Maryland, maybe a little bit north and what the way wrestling fans would think of Mid-Atlantic. And not to be confused, the Mid-Eastern Wrestling Federation is not to be confused with the Middle Eastern Wrestling Federation that WWE, I believe I hear that's going to be launching as a new brand based out of Saudi Arabia. I think it's coming soon to the WWE network. Now, Pillman in 1995... By the way, I have not read his book, Crazy Like a Fox, the book about him, obviously. I mean, he's been dead for 21 years almost now. It just seems crazy to think about. And I have seen the things about his son, Brian Jr., getting into wrestling. I haven't actually seen any of his matches or anything. I've just kind of read that he's there. I should read that Crazy Like a Fox book because I really need to get back into reading. Doing the podcast is cut back on a lot of the reading I would do and how I would review books on section309.com where I would take, you know, passages from it. I think I did 17 parts just on Bret Hart's book. I did 6 parts on Pat Patterson's book. I had a lot of fun doing that. I should actually finish the Bob Backlund book before I go on to anything else. Now, Pillman seemed, I don't want to say aimless in 1994, but it ended up at a point where he was in ECW for a brief period as part of a talent exchange. I know he had one match there around November. And after the Hollywood Blondes break up, and that gets talked about a lot and how, well, that could have gone a lot further than it did with Austin and Pillman and the chemistry that they had in that team. And while that's true, you'd think that maybe coming out of it, both guys would somehow be better for it. But Pillman sort of got Jannettied a bit in 94. Just looking at his results, the last results for him in 1994 in WCW speaks volumes because it is 3 consecutive losses to the Honky Tonk Man on house shows. This is WCW Honky Tonk Man. This is not 1987 Master Heel Honky Tonk Man. So he's kind of floating aimlessly around the mid card, something around, you know, just a cut below that Johnny B. Bad level. And a change has got to come somehow. And it would happen near the end of 1995 when he would eventually evolve into the loose cannon character. It's another example of Brian Pillman was always an outstanding professional wrestler in terms of the work in the ring. His matches are generally enjoyable and all that. But sometimes you need a little bit of a character. Sometimes the character makes the wrestler at the end of the day. And speaking of wrestling, when we start out here, Tony Schiavone with one of the Tony-isms, the full arm drag and twist. And Pillman gets a head scissors and some mat wrestling early on. And Pillman, I think, was kind of very good at that also. It's not something that's talked about. You either talk about how he was a high flyer, a junior heavyweight in his early days and into the early 90s, or you talk about the insanity of the loose cannon character. And I think some of the other stuff that he could do would get lost in the shuffle. And Tony and Bobby on commentary, and I'm not a huge fan of them working together. As we know now, Bobby was not exactly a fan of Tony Schiavone. I guess that there was a breaking point somewhere that would have been after this. They have an argument over Bobby not liking any of the baby faces, which I thought was really strange. Like, well, no shit. He's a heel announcer. He's not going to like any of the... He doesn't like Alex Wright. He doesn't like Sting. I mean, it all seemed kind of pointless. The star does that thing that I love. Whenever a heel accuses someone of pulling hair and using clenched fists when it wasn't necessarily being done, I always enjoy that little spot. It's one of my favorite stall spots that you can possibly do. So please make a note of that. Springboard crossbody by Pillman gets a two count. And this is the kind of stuff, you know, it's gradually starting to work its way into North American wrestling. And Pillman, I don't want to say he was a revolutionary figure per se, but he was certainly at the front of that line. Then Pillman grabs the legs of Starr and kind of arranges it into a figure four position with his arms and starts to turn him over, which we now know is the Texas Cloverleaf, popularized a couple of years after by Dean Malenko in WCW. I'm not sure if he was doing the move in ECW. It's been a while since I've gone back and watched that stuff. But Tony Schiavone is very, very confused by this, and he's never seen it before, and him and Heenan are trying to figure out what to call it.
What is this? It's almost like a figure four applied using the arms. I've never seen that.
It's a figure four crab.
Yeah.
You're going to turn him over into a Boston crab.
A figure four crab. You come up with all these things, don't you?
I'm not in the ring doing it, he is.
Pillman then fakes the springboard from the corner and hits with a missile dropkick. I also like the fake move. Where you kind of do the head fake. It's like the play-action fake of pro wrestling. I recall Coco Beware doing that in WWF, and it's a move that I also enjoy. This is almost like a template of like Pete's greatest hits here. Pillman, I was going to say with a bit of a botch. Oh, first, there is a back suplex by Starr, who... I'm looking at him, and maybe this is unfair. He looks like the love child of The Undertaker and Oliver Humperdinck, which is certainly most unfortunate for him. I was going to say Pillman had a botch here where he comes off the second rope, and it looks like he's got Starr in a head scissors, but nothing happens. Starr doesn't turn or anything like that, so it's not a Rana, it's not a head scissors, and... It just didn't really work well. They said, oh, looks like Starr could have broken his neck on that one, which never a good sign when they're talking about broken necks on commentary. Backdrop, and Pillman locks in. They don't even name this hold. I'm just going to call it a generic crossface, and he picks up a submission victory. So Brian Pillman is confounding me in this match, showing he can do a number of different things. Locking in holds that the announcers don't seem to really know. I don't remember Brian Pillman picking up too many submission wins over the course of his career. It really struck me as a bit odd. And Pillman did not do one chop during the entire match. You know, he became famous earlier in the 90s for, you know, exchanging those chops with Ric Flair when he would have matches with him on television. So very diversified offensive moveset for Flyin' Brian. Yes, he's back to being Flyin' Brian more now than anything else after the dropping of California. But there's more to it than just working in the ring. You have to develop a character if you want to get pushed over the top, both literally and figuratively. And the character of the Loose Cannon, I've said it before, but again, I should say it again, maybe my favorite character in pro wrestling history, just isolating it from everything else, because at the same time, it also makes me sad that he got so into that character that it ended up sinking him in the end, because it was just isolating him from people he knew. And, you know, the car accident was obviously a huge factor as well. But when you sink so deeply into your character and you kind of forget that you are a human being also, there can be an adverse side effect, almost like taking a prescription drug. And I don't want to open that can of worms talking about that, but just really makes me sad thinking about Pillman and the obvious what-ifs that are there.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Hey, dudes, the Hawkster's running wild on WCW. And I want to tell you all about it right now.
Call the Hulk Hogan hotline at 1-900-737-HULK.
It's got 8 incredible options, like Beat the Hulk, Hulk Trivia, and one of my great Hulk messages. There's always something new on the Hulk Hogan hotline.
Call now at 1-900-737-HULK. Calls cost $1.49 per minute. Kids get parents' permission. Charges will appear on parents' phone bill.
For whatever reason, when I watch 94 and 95 WCW Hulk Hogan, I think to myself, there has to be a person out there, and I haven't encountered them yet, maybe you have, who knows, that loves Hulk Hogan from that time period, but doesn't care for the WWF Hulk Hogan of the 80s and early 90s. That person definitely exists. It kind of goes into the whole, when you hear a song, you say, this is somebody's favorite song. There's a person out there that exists for. At 900 numbers, I was kind of interested in wondering about the origin of it. From a mainstream perspective, it's in the very early 80s where it started, in the United States at least. 976 numbers were more regional, mostly turned into sex lines, although some of it would be for race results and stuff like that. The earliest use of a 900 number was viewers of Nightline were encouraged to call in and vote on who they thought won the 1980 presidential debate between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, the one debate that those two guys had one-on-one. Another one was on Saturday Night Live a couple of years later. It was a skit where Eddie Murphy is holding a lobster, Larry the Lobster, and you were encouraged to call this 900 number and vote on whether Larry would live or die. And he ended up living by a rather slim margin, over 520,000 votes, I think it was. And the spike in traffic on those calls was so much that AT&T at that time decided that they needed to form a team to plan for such events that would cause a spike and maybe disruptions in their system.
Bobby Heenan, I think you're going to have to agree with me. Very strange bedfellows indeed. Lord Steven Regal and Bobby Eaton. Given Bobby Eaton is a great tag team special.
Oh, he certainly is, but they need each other. His lordship needs a tag partner.
I feel like I'm being taken away to a different place in time hearing that little snippet with the phrase tag team specialists and Heenan saying they need each other. Just takes me to the barbershop set where Heenan is saying those very things and Gorilla constantly calling the Rockers tag team specialist, but that's in the past. That's over 3 years in the past. We're forming a team this time and not breaking one up. And this is the meeting of Lord Steven Regal and Bobby Eaton. And what a beautiful partnership this would be. No pun intended in this case. And this goes back to, in March, Regal's looking for a tag partner because he wants to kind of break into the tag team ranks and go for those titles. And Bobby Eaton didn't have anything to do, and he approaches Regal a couple of times on WCW Saturday Night asking, and Regal is horrified by some of his manner because he's taking gum out of his mouth or grits or what have you. And Regal just will have none of it. He does not want to team with this country bumpkin, is the way he perceived him. So this eventually leads to a match on WCW Saturday Night, which is very brief. Regal kind of dominates Eaton early with some wrestling moves, and then Eaton fires up, kicks Regal's ass for about 2 minutes, and then goes up top for the Alabama Jam. And when he reaches the top rope, Regal just gets out of Dodge, rolls out of the ring, goes up to the interview area, and proclaims that, maybe he would like to have Eaton as his tag partner after all. And it was particularly strange because Eaton nominally is a babyface during this time, and he just shakes Regal's hand and kind of, they let bygones be bygones there, and just to move forward. But what it leads to is some of the greatest vignettes that you would ever see on wrestling television. This is amazing stuff, which is no surprise from a guy like Regal, who, with his facial expressions and just his general manner, nobody has ever done the British snob character better than him. It's been tried on numerous occasions. Hell, this month in April of 95, you have J.P. Levesque jumping over to the WWF and basically doing the flea market version of Regal and trying like hell to get over for a couple of years and failing miserably. But here's Regal. Okay, so the idea is almost something out of, I don't want to say it's out of Pretty Woman, but it's been done many times, where he's going to make a better man out of Bobby Eaton and kind of bring him into the upper echelons of British society, because he's not going to just team with some dude from Alabama. I'm wondering if maybe in a podcast sense this could be done where, like, I don't know, Alan or Parv from, you know, Pro Wrestling Only could take Conrad Thompson and teach him about nobility in British society. I think that would be a fairly good idea. But Bobby, he's just kind of there. He just kind of has to be himself and let Regal kind of carry the segment with just the way that he is and his manner. So he takes him around and tries to clean him up. And we don't get to see all of the skits here. We don't get to see them clothes shopping, where it's very much like Pretty Woman, where you see Eaton in the various outfits. And in one of them, he looks like the Jim Carrey character, you know, smoking. I think that was the mask. They go out to a restaurant. Eaton is wearing white socks with black shoes and just a mismatched suit outfit. Blows his nose with his napkin and all that sort of stuff. He asks what kind of wine, or he's asked what kind of wine he wants, and then he says the name of a couple of fortified wine companies, if you've ever seen that.
I hope you don't mind, Robert, I took the liberty of ordering the heads. You do like beef, don't you?
Yeah,
cheeseburger stuff.
No,
french fries.
Fine British beef.
Thank you very much, my dear. Thank you. Well, what about a drop of wine, Robert? Do you have a boot form? Oh. Ripple?
What?
No. Why don't we have the usual, please, Robert? That doesn't go on your neck. It goes on your lap, please.
Regal's always been at the forefront of speaking up about napkin etiquette. Recall a Raw promo from, I want to say it was November of 2000, where he has a table there and he's showing proper table manners. Maybe I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but that was actually where I learned that when you have multiple forks, you go outside in. So in a way, wrestling taught me how to properly set tables and why things are done the way they're done. But of course, the money line from that is when he advises on how to use a napkin. Never wipe or smear. That is for another orifice. And then Chris Jericho interrupts him. So they have all sorts of shenanigans outside of the vignette that airs on this show. So here, he's just getting made up in a chair, is Bobby Eaton. I'm not entirely sure what's going on. It almost looks like they're blowing cologne at him or something, but he's just kind of getting made up to look really nice, to meet the queen. As I said, he's got the clothes, he's got the hairstyle. The hair is now slick-backed and is a lot better kept on him. He's been taught table manners and all that. And now Regal wants to work on beautiful Bobby's pronunciation and try and minimize the Alabama accent.
Persevere with it, Roberts. You've got to look our best. It's going to be the biggest day of your life. You're going to meet the Queen of England.
Hey, face your shoulder, your jaws?
I don't think so, no. Now, look, we've got the clothes, we've got the hairstyle, we've even got table manners at last. Now we've still got a lot of work on this pronunciation thing. Repeat after me. How now, brown cow?
How now, brown cow?
I'm sorry, my dear. No. How now, brown cow?
How now, brown cow?
Do you think I'll get to see her jewels? I don't know who was writing this stuff, but it's so unbelievably brilliant. How WCW Saturday Night did not win an Emmy for Best Comedy in early 1995, I have no idea, just on the strength of this. And Regal, what makes him so great is, I know in WWF, particularly on Raw, they always like to incorporate current events into what they're doing. And Regal, being a nobleman of British society, takes a swipe at stuff that was then going on in the news there.
I think the best thing that we can do is that you just kneel and I'll do all the talking, okay? And just keep smiling, and whatever you do, don't mention Fergie.
So nobody has really thought of Sarah Ferguson, the Duchess of York, in the United States for quite some time, but she was involved in any number of different scandals at the time. In fact, in the United States, she's probably best known for her Weight Watchers commercials that she did for a very long time, which kind of earned her the derisive nickname, the Duchess of Pork. But some of the scandals, you know, she was getting in the middle of a divorce from Prince Andrew. She was photographed topless on a beach by a British tabloid, which is pretty much par for the course, as I understand those newspapers. She sent flowers to Princess Margaret at one point and actually got this reply. I should mention that Princess Margaret is the aunt of her estranged husband, Prince Andrew. And her thank you note back for the flowers said, "You have done more to bring shame on the family than could have ever been imagined." That is one hell of a thank you note. And also, later in 95, she managed to lose $250,000 or 250,000 euros worth of jewels. I don't know why it was valued as such, because euros and Great Britain has never used euros. I don't understand why it said that way. A guy doing luggage at, I think, one of the New York airports was busted stealing that amount of jewels from Fergie's bag. So there was always something going on with her. In fact, she was kind of overshadowing, I think, at times, some of the Charles and Diana nonsense that was going on. So we go to Buckingham Palace, and we're going to get the knighting of Bobby Eaton. And Regal's reaction to this is just so unbelievably priceless. And it doesn't really work and translate as well on an audio podcast, but trust me, just go and watch the video of this. It's some of the best stuff ever.
The transformation in yourself, Roberts, has been nothing short of a miracle. I mean, when I first met you a few months ago, I mean, I couldn't understand a word, not a word that you were saying. And now look, your English grammar is quite perfect. I mean,
what was I thinking?
I,
don't know. I mean, what?
Now you see what it's like to be in the upper echelons of British hierarchy. You won't want anything else. Life is such a pleasure. Let's go. Bye.
Robert.
Wonderful. I remember this when it was happening to me.
There is some confusion on my part as to what kind of nobility Lord Stephen Regal is, because Lord is kind of used to refer to different levels of the chain of nobility in the United Kingdom. Dukes, marquesses, earls, viscounts, barons. Out of those five, earls is ranked third. So I don't quite get it. I think they probably were just looking for a term to throw on him. Eventually you get Squire David Taylor, which I think is lower than an earl. So I'm not entirely sure what Regal exactly was, but to me he can be whatever the hell he wants if he's going to be putting stuff out there like this, because he deserved an Emmy himself for those tears that he produced upon seeing Eaton be knighted by the Queen. It's really, by the way, he's definitely going to be the show image for this show. You know, I have to do two of them for my own feed and for the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I mean, there's so much to choose from just from these two vignettes. And there is a little coda here after all this, as they end their day with a shoe shine. And they are reading the paper. And once again, you know, they have a little back and forth. They're kind of cementing Eaton's turn into British nobility and his newfound snobbishness and all that. But Regal still finds time to take a swipe at Fergie.
It used to be the Duke of York that had 10,000 men. Now it's the Duchess. Anyway, Robert, this has been an absolutely wonderful day, hasn't it? I wonder what the poor people are doing. Who cares?
So Eaton's now a snob, and Regal has just given us the classiest possible way to call somebody a slut. I mean, that is so phenomenal. And the way they put this together, I don't know how you can't enjoy something like this. But this being WCW, you know, you think, okay, well, clearly they're going to get a tag team title run at some point. No, that wouldn't happen. Because in World Championship Wrestling, whenever you would do something right, there's always going to be two or more things that are going to be done wrong in the follow-up. And yes, they would team through 1995 and had some success and maybe bleed a little into 1996. But Regal would go back more into singles competition and leave the tag ranks, because the team kind of ended up not really going much of anywhere. Didn't really get to the tag team title level. And it's a damn shame, because it got off to as good a start as you could have possibly hoped for. It gave something to do to Bobby Eaton, a magnificent wrestler for so many years. I mean, you go all the way back to the early 80s at him in Memphis and his team with Coco Beware. Just giving him something to do. And this is pretty much the last bit of relevance he would have, sadly. And pairing him alongside a guy like Regal, who can take anything. He could be paired with Tajiri. You name it. He can make it work. He can make it be funny. And not only is Regal great for all those reasons, but he's also the only authority figure in any wrestling promotion who has been worth a damn for at least the last decade.
Well, that is a fool. Unbelievable.
Hey, Lord!
Wait a minute, child. Oh, look at this. All I got left out a bunch of stones I got on there.
Give me a second.
No wonder you're trying to use American dollars in English.
Hold here. What on earth are you wearing?
Oh, I got my house got my last.
Look like a reject from Saturday Night Fever. White socks and black shoes. We're going to a fine dining establishment.
I'm hungry.
Trying to embarrass me. There's people I know here.
I'm hungry.
Come on.
All right, now that I've made clear how much I really love that, we go to a tag team match, which is actually joined in progress from the WCW Saturday night from the day before. It's Johnny B. Badd and Alex Wright taking on stunning Steve Austin and Arn Anderson under the tutelage of Colonel Robert Parker. And as I said, it's like a Greetings from Allentown all-star game going on here. Arn and Austin is certainly no surprise, you know, how much, I mean, pretty much everybody likes those guys. Johnny B. Badd, I've made the case on several occasions that his character work is really, really good. I know a lot of people frown upon some of his in-ring work, but he always gave an honest effort, and he tried hard, and he got better as time went along. And I don't know how much more you can ask for than that. And Alex Wright, you know, it was also a pretty good wrestler at the time period, but mainly my focus on him is always how that Berlin gimmick in 1999 should have worked. At some point, I will get to that whole thing. And the fact that it didn't work really, you know, really kind of bothers me. And I don't understand why Alex Wright got shit on a couple of times. The match with Paul Roma in 1995 on a pay-per-view where he basically got sandbagged, and Roma, Paul Roma going out there and deciding not to make a guy look good. I mean, that's just rich there. And then Fall Brawl 99, Buff Bagwell doesn't show up for the match with Berlin, so he has to face Duggan, and Duggan doesn't particularly try very hard to make Berlin look good anyway. But that's for another time. So we have this match here, and it is very much clipped. I don't know if they brought in Ed Whalen from Stampede to do some of the editing here. I mean, the video is only 39 minutes, so I don't know if maybe they really did have to edit it down. And Johnny B. Badd is working over the left leg of Austin and eventually tags out to Alex Wright and European uppercuts as mandated because, you know, he's from Germany. So Austin ends up flying over the top rope, but this is not a DQ because apparently Austin went over based on his own momentum. We get a clip now, so we jump to Arn Anderson and Alex Wright just sort of duking it out, and then we get a tag to Johnny B. Badd, a hot tag as it were. And Badd and Arn, they were in the middle of their little feud, which had a boxer versus wrestler match with Arn Anderson being the classic wrestler and Johnny B. Badd calling back to his boxing days. Very early on, much was made about him being a boxer when he came in as a heel alongside Teddy Long. And that was at Uncensored 95, a pay-per-view that, for whatever reason, I can inexplicably sit through and mildly enjoy. And Arn loses against Johnny B. Badd. As I recall, I think this is the one where the bucket ends up over his head. And it's kind of a rough 95 for Arn Anderson. And between that and the Renegade and having to face Ric Flair eventually down the road at Fall Brawl 95, you know, there's just a lot of it. And Badd is running over both of his opponents here. And we kind of go into the finish as Austin is struggling to do a pile driver correctly, which he should remember something like that. Like, maybe just phase out all pile driver and pile driver related material from his matches. It might be the best for him going forward. He's trying to get Badd up, and he's struggling for a very unnaturally long time. Feels like a cue might have been missed by Alex Wright. And eventually, Austin turns and faces the corner where Alex Wright flies off the top with a crossbody. And it looks like he's going to get the pin, but Colonel Robert Parker and his giant penis come in for the DQ. Eat your heart out, Joey Ryan. And that is how that match ends. You get a little brawl there, and then Sting runs in and makes the save. I wasn't quite sure what to make of this because it was so heavily clipped, and they didn't show the heels getting any sort of offense whatsoever. It does seem like a common thing for WCW Saturday Night around that time. You know, I covered one from 93 where it was just two baby faces thrown together to face the two heels, just kind of as your feature bout. I mean, now that I think about it, it's really kind of a common trope all through wrestling history. I mean, every single Raw or SmackDown, the the basic main event is we're going to take two guys who had an argument with each other, either team them together or put them on opposite sides of a tag match, because you're not going to give away necessarily the singles match, although they will do that from time to time.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a vertical podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcast.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows plus others available at PlaceFormation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceFormation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in Worcester, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and thehistoryofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceFormation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Certainly encourage you to listen to Wrestling Warzone, the Monday Night Wars, on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed with those two gentlemen, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell. So they're examining a very interesting period in history, which is shortly after the one that I'm covering. Their show this week will be on WWS In Your House 3 from September of 1995. And it's just an interesting time because it's the start of real head-to-head competition, but before one of them was going to be dominant over the other. I mean, you get the 83 weeks with Nitro over Raw, and then you have Raw taking the lead and really never relinquishing it. This jockeying back and forth for position from September of 95 through the spring of 96 is certainly an interesting time to kind of look back and see what the two companies were doing. And as always, I encourage you to listen to our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, and also the wrestling podcast About Nothing. And I have to send an apology to, not Mike Crockett, but to Brian Malonis, or I cannot go to the ROH show that was last night. I'm having kind of a mind screw here, because the ROH show at the Lowell Memorial Auditorium was last night, and I was unable to go because I had other commitments and all that. It's a shame, too, because that's like literally the closest wrestling venue to my house. But I'm certainly going to go to the next Chaotic Wrestling show, which is on a Thursday night. I'm very happy about that because it's going to start a little earlier, and presumably I'll get out of there a little early. I'll pretend like I'm going to a hockey game is the way I'm going to do that, like going out on a weeknight. Yeah. And coming up next here, we have Sergeant Craig Pitbull Pittman taking on Tracy Benton, which, I don't know, when I saw the name Tracy Benton, I was like, is that some sort of kind of like child actress from like 1981 or something? Was she on Soap or Benson or something like that? Like, no, none of that. That was Missy Gold, actually, who, by the way, is now a psychologist up in Maine, or psychiatrist, or whatever it is. Anyway, just to avoid talking about Pittman, because he's been on the show before. I think he was on both WCW Prime shows that I did. He's still fairly new in April of 95. He had a very weird feud with Cobra. And not to go back to issues of the military once again, but the whole feud was based upon Cobra being abandoned in some sort of mission in Iraq. And now he's decided to come back to WCW to seek revenge, not through a court martial or anything like that.
and not attacking him on the street or taking his revenge that way. No, no. I'm going to sign up, train to be a pro wrestler, and I'm going to get my revenge that way. It's really kind of sad and weird when you drill down further on it. But Pittman actually has some interesting info on him at this time in 1995, because he was kind of fancying himself a little bit as a Deion Sanders, a multi-sport threat, because he had made his MMA debut. And I should be careful here, because I'm really out of my depth talking about UFC and any sort of mixed martial arts, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, at the Valet Tudo Japan 1995. God, I hope I pronounced that correctly. And this was some sort of tournament that he was a part of, and he beat fellow American Wayne Emmons by submission using an arm triangle choke, but then he later lost to Yuki Nakai of Japan. And he ended up with a 2-2 record for his career in MMA. But the strange thing is, he has these two bouts in 1995 and then doesn't have another one until 2011. So he went 16 years. And then he had another MMA match in 2012. So that wraps things up for him. And Pittman, again, I don't really care for him too much as a worker. There's a certain clumsiness to what he does at times. But Bobby Heenan, a lot is made about his WCW announcing being kind of checked out, but that's really after a certain period of time when he was kind of floating aimlessly and not really a focused heel commentator. Here, he's still trying. And by the way, I loved his performance at Uncensored 95 because he was clearly being sarcastic by saying, "It's uncensored," over and over again. But here, he's trying to put Pittman over. Sure, he's not going to be his manager when Pittman asks him the following year. But he does spin a yarn about his time in the Marines.
Well, he's had the Marine Corps drummed in him, hasn't he? Wow. I heard the recruits he used to bring through would beg to go home. They would beg for their mother. They would cry at night. Some of them got out on mental discharges. I mean, this is just one big tough man. And he won't let up on you.
Here's one of the problems with watching Pittman in retrospect. This might not have been an issue at the time for some people because of footage not being readily available, but if you were a longtime fan, it's natural to compare this guy with the Sergeant Slaughter heel character of the early 1980s, which I've gone through in other episodes, like episode 38, when he's doing the Cobra Clutch Challenge in WWF. And, you know, he's did the Cobra Clutch Challenge in Mid-Atlantic as well. There's absolutely no way for Pittman to be able to do that sadistic Marine drill sergeant character as well as Slaughter did. So it's going to be tough to anybody with some sort of institutional memory to get over with those people. And especially now, where you've seen all of Slaughter's work from those days, and you look at this guy Pittman, and there's really no category where he would rank above the Sarge. In fact, at one point here, he starts working the right arm of Benton, which I thought was strange because this is not Mexico. Then he just takes a break to do a couple of push-ups for whatever reason, just to kind of taunt. Then he goes back to the left arm. And this is off a botched Irish whip move. I don't know exactly what he was going for, because this seems to happen in every Craig Pittman match where something happens where I don't know what the hell he was trying to do. And I think he finally realizes it and just goes for the code red arm breaker and picks up the win. The one thing he was good at that I maybe mildly enjoy is shouting promos into the corner camera after his matches. He seemed to really like doing that. But the lesson here is that it's tough to do a gimmick that had been done before and done so very well, especially when there's really no chance that you're ever going to live up to it.
This is how we do.
Going into the next segment, I'm reminded a little bit of H. Ross Perot and his 1992 presidential campaign. Let me explain for a second. As you may recall, back then, in a land with no internet or anything like that, Perot, who was self-financing his campaign, would actually buy half-hour time slots on network television, usually like on a Sunday night or whatever, and would basically just give a long infomercial to the people. So instead of buying time for a 30-second ad or a one-minute ad, he would go on for 30 minutes with charts and graphs and this sort of stuff. It was a really large time buy for a political candidate. And so it is with Ric Flair here. And the similarity between the two are that Perot was an outsider running as an independent candidate in 1992, trying to buck his way into the system. And he had a lot of impact going forward in some areas. Flair is on the outside looking in because of the retirement stipulation. So he's, you know, trying to get back into the game. So he works a time buy here, but he's also working a bit. Now, Ross Perot was hilarious as well. Thank you very much, Dana Carvey on SNL. Flair is also working a bit here. I don't know who's writing all the early 95 WCW stuff again, but it's working for me. Now, comedy over continuity, that should be the motto of WCW in this time in 1995. And Flair is working a bit here, because he's using a sense of humor to try and work his way back into an active status. And he calls this thing, Be Fair to Flair, the line that Bobby Heenan said over and over again during the 1992 Royal Rumble. And also, I believe the name of a GWE podcast series that the legendary Parv did over five parts that I particularly enjoyed. I guess it got some backlash on PWO. I've heard somebody refer to that series as, quote, Nuremberg rallies, but that's neither here nor there. I still love Ric Flair. And he is with a young woman named Magenta, who I think the purpose of her being there is just to have a woman standing next to Ric Flair. And she's very, very short compared to Ric. I'm not entirely sure what to make of her presence there. Now, the intro gets us off to a pretty hilarious start.
The following is paid for by Ric Flair. Ric Flair the athlete. Ric Flair the philanthropist. Ric Flair the scholar. Ric Flair the kind. Ric Flair the just.
Ric Flair the drinker.
It is of his desire to once again express to the fans, board of directors, and wrestlers of WCW that his retirement is permanent and final, and that over the past few months his good name has been wrongfully and unjustly smeared. It is with this in mind that he wishes all parties to be fair to Flair.
All right, so they're making it seem like he doesn't want to be reinstated, that he's actually retired, and that he just wants to restore his good name. I mean, that kind of is at odds with the fact that he's constantly hanging around Vader and hassling Hogan and all that sort of stuff. Basically, you know, taking pinfalls and strap matches, stuff like that. I was wondering how much further they were going to go with that Ric Flair, the hot air balloon enthusiast. Ric Flair, the landscaper. I mean, they could have gone on and on and on, and it would have still been funny, but you're going to get diminishing returns. So why don't we get to Flair actually addressing the situation?
You know, Magenta, when all else fails, I've always been able to make an appeal to a beautiful woman. Women relate to Ric Flair. They understand me because they see the greatness in me. And right now, I'm walking that fine line. I'm in political exile. I'm caught up in Ric Flair's own world. Hogan wants me. Savage wants me. Sting wants me. Bockwinkle wants me. The whole world wants Ric Flair. But I'm on the outside right now, looking in. I'm looking good, though, aren't I? Don't get too excited. Don't give them too much right now, Magenta. You see, they don't understand what this is all about. This is about Ric Flair, the greatest of all time. I've styled and I've profiled. I've walked that aisle. I've danced all night. I've been Ric Flair all around the world 11 times. I've been the greatest of all time. This is paid for by Ric Flair. So watch it.
So I do think there's some credence to my what women want scenario that I mentioned earlier, but I also think that Magenta might be there to help Ric kind of be funny, to turn it up a notch. You know, I have this, listening to the Adam Carolla show for a long time, I find that sometimes he is funnier if he has an attractive female guest. kind of, you know, came to that conclusion years ago. I think it was Natasha Leggero that he had on the show, and he was on a particular roll with just funny stuff. So the thought is, you know, just have the woman stand there, you know, as long as she's to his liking, and just let him roll. And he does show clips of him with a couple of ladies at the January 95 Clash of the Champions, just kind of walking that aisle, as it were. So chopping and suplexing on offense. The last thing you see is him tossing Nikita Koloff out of the ring at Starrcade 86. I'm not sure if that was the move that caused Nikita's nutsack to pop out of his tights and Tommy Young to have to put it back in, but I don't even want to think about that. And then finally, a figure four on Hogan from the Bash at the Beach the previous July. So he's quite proud of all of his accomplishments, and just a reminder that he is one of the greatest. I'm not going to say the greatest, because I still rank Terry Funk number one. But in keeping up with the comedic bit that he's doing here, he takes a page out of David Letterman's playbook. And Letterman was still trying, I think, in 1995. I never particularly cared that much for David Letterman. His 80s stuff was better. And then when he lost the Tonight Show gig to the superior Jay Leno, who then went on to beat his ass in the ratings for about two decades, Letterman started mailing it in, you know, pretty much on a nightly basis. He would record his Friday show on Monday, which is like the ultimate sign of, you know, not even trying, because your monologue jokes are rapidly out of date. Anyway, enough on Letterman. Flair decides to do a top 10 list. And I'll be honest, I think this is better than any top 10 list I ever heard on the Letterman show.
I'm going to give you one last trick. Everybody out there, 10 reasons why WCW should be fair to Ric Flair. Number 10, the figure four leg lock. I made it a household name. Number 9, without me, everyone thinks Alex Wright can dance. Can you imagine that magenta? Number 8, I'm living up to my end of the bargain. I haven't wrestled since October. Number 7, because I just might buy the company and fire everyone.
Ooh.
Number 6, I'm still in everyone's mind. Just listen to Hogan and Savage. Number 5, women are going crazy. Look what happened to Savage's Uncensored. A half-crazed woman came out of the stands and beat him up. Number 4, if I'm not in WCW, what are they going to do? Close down Space Mountain? Number 3, the whole world's going through Flair withdrawal. Number 2, I'm a kiss-stealing, wheeling-dealing, limousine-riding, jet-flying son of a gun. And the number 1 reason WCW should be fair to Flair is... Woo!
It's just great stuff. And if it wasn't for the Regal and Eaton stuff, it would be the best thing on this show. So from a comedic perspective, this show is just very, very strong. But because it's WCW, there's always got to be something wrong with it. And in this case, when they talk about everyone going through Ric Flair withdrawals, they spelled withdrawal wrong on the graphic. So maybe only a minor quibble there. So some nice stuff from Flair. If you're not going to use him as an active wrestler, you might as well just let him cut loose and be entertaining and funny. Because this is the entertainment business. Not everything has to be completely serious. If he wants to be kind of a comedic figure off to the side, to me, that's great. No, no, no. Time for the feature bout on WCW Main Event. This is an exclusive to this show. The tag team champions Harlem Heat taking on the Nasty Boys. Quite the rivalry during 1995. And I had said earlier something to the effect of comedy over continuity. in 1995 WCW. And yeah, some of the comedy may not have worked for some people, but the continuity mistakes will live on forever. The Nasty Boys did a what is known in the stock market as a short sell of the tag team titles by losing them before they had actually won them. It's kind of like in the stock market when you sell shares you don't have and then you borrow it and then you buy it back later at a lower price and give back those shares to the original person. That's kind of how that works. They won the tag team titles at Slamboree on May 21st. However, at the worldwide tapings, and of course this is down Disney or Universal or whatever, they had lost those titles on May 3rd. To Harlem Heat, who were the champions in reality on May 3rd, but they didn't actually air it until the June 24th episode of Worldwide. So they had a title reign of about a month, a little over a month, from May 21st to June 24th in TV world, but in reality, their title reign was negative 18 days, which all sounds absurd to do in a wrestling context, but this is not the first time that WCW would do this, and it would not be the last time, not even the last time in 1995. And the Nasty Boys open this one up by sneaking up from behind. They don't come out the usual entrance way, get a slugfest early on. And interestingly, we have Tony Schiavone and Dusty Rhodes on the call here. So welcome back to Greetings from Allentown, Dream. And Dusty says that WCW has been fair to Flair, and that just immediately makes me think, yes, they were very fair in late 1988 when you, Dusty, the booker, granted it was still Jim Crockett Promotions at this point, but, you know, the continuity of it all there, I'm going to count it, when you wanted him to lose to Rick Steiner at Starrcade in 5 minutes and just to get the title off him and to spite him. So, yes, maybe not always. Maybe you're not the one who should be talking about them being fair to Flair. Knobs has control over Booker T and then tags out to young Conrad Thompson. I mean, Jerry Sags. I don't know. I saw that picture. It's kind of funny stuff there of good old Conrad as a young lad dressing up as Jerry Sags for some reason. Not exactly the guy I would cosplay, but whatever. And they're really cutting off the ring. And you're not going to believe this, but when they do a double team in the corner, Dusty announces, "We got a clubber in."
There you go. Boy, that's clever. That's right. Right there. I taught you that. That's clever. That full fist on one noggin. That's clever, brother. And the Nasty Boys are clever right here on the main event.
Whoa. I'm really glad Dusty was doing this match because I was starting to get bored a bit watching these two teams. And the Nasty Boys, I think, by any account, was a little bit past their peak. Very spring of 1994 was their best moment in WCW. And Harlem Heat, I'm not sure is entirely there yet because it would take Booker T a little while before he would become kind of the big star that he eventually would be down the road. Tag to Stevie Ray, but he gets worked over by the Nasties as well. But when Booker gets back in the what would become, I guess, the Harlem Sidekick. But then he gets worked over a little bit more, and then things flip. Sags is in peril. My notes are just very bad here because I just kind of lost interest in this match halfway through because then there's a chin lock because that's what we need. Maybe this is why I do stick to jobber matches. I'm not entirely sure. A scissor kick by Booker T, the move that more or less ended Rick Martel's career, so it always kind of hurts me to see that. But then he is caught by Sags coming off the ropes, and then Knobs comes in. A lot of clotheslines from Brian Knobs. They had to get a two count out of it, and then on another pin attempt, Sensuous Sherry or Sister Sherry just comes running across the ring to break up the pin, but there's no DQ. So I'm scratching my head. Okay, we had Colonel Robert Parker and his giant hog do the exact same thing earlier in this show, which got an immediate disqualification, but okay, that's fine. And then Knobs tosses Booker over the top rope. And that's an immediate DQ in WCW land. But it ends up actually being a double DQ because then they retroactively apply the DQ for Sherry's interference. So 1995 WCW, everybody. It is what it is, I guess. And I mean, How does this work? I mean, don't do the same stuff in the same show where you do different things. Just try to maintain just that one bit of continuity. I don't even care about negative tag team title reigns. Just don't do the same thing twice on a show and then have it go two different ways. Sherry, in the notes for this episode on historyofwwe.com, says on her way out of the main arena area that the Nasties will be getting no more title shots, but we don't get to see that on the video here. I don't know if it was cut for whatever reason by the uploader. Of course, they would get more shots because the damn title changes at Slamboree anyway. So, as you can kind of guess from the way I approached this match, I really did not care for this bout. But, you know, sometimes with this promotion in this year, you have to take the bad with the good. And they go back to the main desk there with Okerlund and Heenan. And in a nice little flashback to the good old days of primetime wrestling, he is screwing around on his telephone that is on his desk. It's always something that he would kind of have, it seems, in the era before cell phones were completely ubiquitous. And he's trying to get some more info on the Ric Flair reinstatement hearing, which they allege is going on at that very moment. So Heenan, once again, working the broadcast journalist angle, a couple of years after leaving the WWF, where he would kind of press that a lot more. And that is how they close, believe it or not, on WCW Main Event for April 2nd, 1995. And people can now turn to their pay-per-view channel in real time to WrestleMania 11 and see the Blue Brothers take on the Allied Powers. But I am not done. There will be no YouTube comment theater this week because most of the comments are just either thanking the uploader or going over stuff that I already talked about, like the WCW Executive Committee and the makeup of them and all that. So I'd like to debut a new segment called Chef Pete Recommend, because I can't enjoy baseball this summer. I might as well enjoy making stuff on my Weber grill. And that's kind of how I'm going to base my recommendation, on my Weber gas grill. I think it's the Genesis model, came out around 2010 or 2011. And what I'd like to give my recipe for today is for a pork shoulder, or what you sometimes see in the supermarket as Boston butt, which is one of the more hilarious names of the things you can buy in, you know, the butcher section or the meat section of your local supermarket. First, I recommend you get maybe the smallest one you can get. Unless you have a large family, I like to get one as small as 6 or 7 pounds, because it's just me and my wife here. Sometimes you have to get an 8-pound one. That kind of comes in on the cooking time, so you just kind of want to factor that in. But now, on the day that you're making it, you want to do this early in the morning, because this will take a lot of time. First thing you want to do when you take it out of the package is you want to dry that sucker off as much as possible. Make sure there's no juices or anything on there. You dry it down so that when you rub it, none of it will run off or anything. So once you've dried it, then you want to trim anything that might be hanging off there. It's just good because it'll render off in your grill, and you really don't want that to happen, because it'll just be kind of messy in the cleanup on the back end. Then you want to season it with any sort of dry rub that you might want to. I prefer the Salt Lick seasoning from the barbecue joint down in Austin, Texas. And you can overdo it a little bit when you're doing something like pulled pork, because you're going to have it out there for so long and it's such a big cut that it's going to take a while for all of it to kind of sink in. Now, once you season it, what I recommend is that you wrap it in like a saran wrap or plastic wrap for a little while, until you're getting close to putting it on your grill there. And that way it'll kind of, you know, then the seasoning has absolutely nowhere to go. Now you want to take wood chips, and you would need a smoker box for something like this. You don't need necessarily a whole smoker to make something like this. You can do it on a Weber gas grill. For wood chips, I recommend mixing hickory with some kind of fruit for a pork shoulder Boston butt, like an apple, an apricot, or cherry wood, and you want to soak those in a bowl for 40 minutes. And you're going to have to repeat that as you do multiple boxes. When you start up your grill, what you want to do is you want to only cook from one end of it. So I use the right burner, and eventually I put the pork on the left side. And I use the rib and roast holder that Weber sells that I can then put the Boston butt in so that it's not touching the actual grill itself, and that way the smoke can more envelop it. So it's completely indirect heat. And you want the temperature on it. You can go as low as, say, 220. That will extend your time on making a proper Boston butt pork shoulder so that you can have pulled pork. I let it run as high as 250 and even up to 275, and you'll see why as we get through this. And you want to put your smoker box over the heat source right at the beginning, after you've let it soak for about 40 minutes in that bowl. And you should get smoke that blows over and envelops, as I said, the Boston butt. And you want to do 4 or 5 rounds of this. And you want, my general guideline is once every hour, you want to refill your smoker box. It's a good idea to have 2 smoker boxes so that you can kind of alternate between the 2 of them. And what you want to do is you want to get the temperature of your Boston butt up to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry, I don't do Celsius. So that's not my thing. I recommend, if you can, getting it up to 195 to 200, because then it makes it really easy to pull apart in the aftermath. And it's a good idea to rotate the roast or the pulled pork or the shoulder every 2 hours or so, just so you can get a more even cook on it. And then the fun begins afterwards when you pull out the shoulder blade. It's on there, and then you can just go to town pulling it apart any way you wish, because the collagens melt down, and it's so easy when you get it up to that higher temperature. And then what you have is delicious pulled pork for probably about a week. In fact, I'm going to be putting it on my salad today, which is very unconventional, but it's what I have in my fridge. I have a lot of pulled pork on hand, and that is how you make a proper pork shoulder. All right, that seemed like a good enough excuse to play the This Week in Baseball theme as music, and probably going to just wrap it up there. I don't have anything set in stone for next week's show, but I'm hoping that I'll certainly have something. Even though, as I said, I'll be traveling over the weekend the next 2 weeks, I do hope to have a show out next Thursday. Just give me a follow on social media. I'll probably post it on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod for what the next show will be. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, Apple Music, whatever the hell they want to call it. 5 stars is always appreciated. And tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Repeat after me. How now, brown cow?
How now, brown cow?